you frankly. I'm a thoughtless person. I asked you on Frida's behalf only because I was careless enough to give her real hope. She's waiting, monsieur. She believes in my power. And if her hope is betrayed, I'll be in an awful position. I'll have no peace for the rest of my life. It can't be helped. It just happened that way.
Oh, said Voland. That's understandable.
So, will you do it? Asked Margarita softly.
No, never, answered Voland. The fact is, dear Queen, there's been a slight mix-up here. Each department should concern itself with its own business. I don't dispute that our resources are quite extensive, much more extensive, in fact, than certain not very discerning people suppose.
Yes, much more extensive, chimed in the cat, unable to restrain himself, evidently priding himself on these resources.
Be quiet, the devil take you, said Voland, and continued, turning to Margarita. But really, what sense is there in doing what is supposed to be the business of another, as I put it, department? And so, I will not do it. But you shall.
Do I really have the power?
Azazello gave Margarita an ironical sidelong glance and snorted with an imperceptible shake of his red head.
So do it, then. This is torture, muttered Voland.
He gave his globe a turn and began focusing on some detail there, evidently preoccupied with another matter during his conversation with Margarita.
Well, say Frida, prompted Korovyov. Frida! Came Margarita's piercing cry. The door flew open, and a disheveled, naked woman with frenzied eyes, but no longer showing any signs of intoxication, burst into the room and stretched out her hands to Margarita, who said majestically, "You are forgiven. You will not be given the handkerchief any more."
Frida let out a wail, fell prostrate on the floor, stretched out like a cross in front of Margarita. Voland waved his hand, and Frida vanished from sight.
Thank you. And farewell, said Margarita, and got up to go.
Well, Behemoth, began Voland, let's not take advantage of an impractical person's folly on a holiday night.
He turned to Margarita.
And so, that didn't count, because, after all, I did nothing. What do you want for yourself?
Silence ensued, and it was broken by Korovyov, who whispered in Margarita's ear,
My diamond Donna, I advise you to be a little more sensible this time, otherwise good fortune may pass you by.
I want this very instant, right now, to have my lover, the master, return to me, said Margarita, and a spasm contorted her face.
At this point, a wind tore into the room with such force that the candles in the candelabra almost blew out. The heavy curtain on the window moved aside, and the window flew open, revealing high up in the distance a full moon, but a midnight moon rather than a morning one. A greenish square of a nocturnal light fell from the windowsill onto the floor, and in it appeared Ivan's night visitor, who called himself the master. He was in his hospital clothes, a robe, slippers, and the little black cap he never parted with. His unshaven face twitched in a grimace. He looked askance with crazy, fearful eyes at the light from the candles, and a flood of moonlight seethed around him. Margarita recognized him immediately. She let out a moan, clasped her hands, and ran to him. She kissed his forehead, his lips, pressed her face against his prickly cheek, and long pent-up tears streamed freely down her face. She uttered only one word, senselessly repeating it over and over, You, you, you. The master pushed her away and said in a hollow voice, Don't cry, Margot. Don't torment me. I'm seriously ill. He grabbed a hold of the windowsill, as if intending to jump on it and run, stared, baring his teeth at the seated company, and began to shout, I'm frightened, Margot. I've started having hallucinations again. Sobs stifled Margarita, and she whispered, choking on her words,
No, 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 don't be afraid of anything. I'm with you, I'm with you.
Deftly and unobtrusively, Korovyov pushed a chair over to the master, who sat down on it, and Margarita fell on her knees, pressing herself against the sick man's side, and thus grew calm. In all her excitement, she had not noticed that her nakedness was suddenly gone, and she was now wearing a black silk cloak. The sick man lowered his head and began staring at the floor with sick, sullen eyes.
"Yes," began Volant after a silence. "They've done quite a job on him."
He commanded Kuravyov, "Knight, give this man a little something to drink."
Margarita coaxed the master in a trembling voice. "Drink it, drink it. Are you afraid to? No, no, believe me, they'll help you."
The sick man took the glass and drank what was in it, but his hand shook and the empty glass smashed at his feet.
"A lucky sign, a lucky sign," whispered Kuravyov to Margarita. "See, he's already getting better."
Indeed, the sick man's gaze no longer seemed so wild and distraught.
"But is it really you, Margot?" asked the moonlight guest.
"Have no doubt, it's me," Margarita replied.
"Give him some more," ordered Volant. After the master had drained a second glass, his eyes looked alive and comprehending.
"Well, now, that's something else entirely," said Volant, narrowing his eyes. "Now let's talk. Who are you?"
"Now I am no one," replied the master, his mouth twisted in a smile.
"Where did you just come from?"
"From an insane asylum. I'm mentally ill," replied the newcomer. Margarita could not stand to hear these words and burst into tears again. Then she wiped her eyes and cried,
"Horrible words, horrible words. He's the master, monsieur. I can assure you of that. Cure him. He deserves it."
"Do you know whom you are speaking to now?" Volant asked the newcomer. "Do you know whose guest you are?"
"Yes," answered the master. "My neighbor in the madhouse was that boy, Ivan Bezdomny. He told me about you."
"Well, well," replied Volant. "I had the pleasure of meeting that young man at Patriarch's Ponds. He nearly drove me out of my mind, trying to prove to me that I don't exist. But you, do you believe that it's really me?"
"I have to believe that," said the newcomer, "although it would, of course, be a lot more soothing to regard you as a product of my hallucinations. Excuse me," added the master, catching himself.
"Well, if it's more soothing, then by all means do so," replied Volant politely.
"No, no," said Margarita fearfully, shaking the master by the shoulder. "Come to your senses. It really is him."
The cat put in a word here as well.
"But I really do look like a hallucination. Look at my profile in the moonlight."
The cat crawled into a strip of moonlight and wanted to say something else, but was asked to be quiet, so he replied,
all right, I'm ready to be quiet. I'll be a silent hallucination,"
and fell silent.
"But tell me, why does Margarita call you the master?" asked Volant.
The newcomer laughed and said, "A pardonable weakness on her part. She has too high an opinion of the novel I wrote."
"What is the novel about?"
"It is about Pontius Pilate." Here again, the tongues of flame on the candles began to flicker and jump. The dishes started rattling on the table, and Volant burst out into thunderous laughter, but no one was frightened or surprised by this. For some reason, Behemoth began to applaud.
"About what? About what? About whom?"
said Volant after he stopped laughing.
"In these times? Why, that's stupendous. Couldn't you find another subject? Let me have a look at it."
Volant stretched out his hand, palm upward. "Unfortunately, I can't do that," replied the master, "because I burned it in the stove."
"Forgive me, but I don't believe you," said Volant. "That cannot be. Manuscripts don't burn."
He turned to Behemoth and said,
"Well, now, Behemoth, let's have the novel."
The cat jumped off the chair instantly, and everyone saw that he had been sitting on a thick pile of manuscripts.
The cat handed the top one to Voland with a bow. Again, almost in tears, Margarita started trembling and shouting, "There it is! The manuscript! There it is!" She threw herself at Voland and added rapturously, "He's omnipotent! Omnipotent!" Voland took the copy handed to him, turned it over, put it aside, and stared silently and unsmilingly at the master. For no apparent reason, the latter suddenly became distressed and anxious, got up from his chair, wrung his hands, and turning to the distant moon, began trembling and muttering, "Even at night, in the moonlight, I have no peace. Why have they disturbed me? Oh, gods, gods!" Margarita clutched at his hospital robe, pressed close to him, and began muttering in tears and anguish, "My God, why isn't the medicine helping you?" "Never mind, never mind, never mind," whispered Korovyov, weaving about near the master. "Never mind, never mind. Just have another glass, and I'll keep you company." And the little glass twinkled and sparkled in the moonlight. And that glass did help. They sat the master in his place, and the sick man's face became calm.
"Well, now everything is clear," said Voland, drumming on the manuscript with his middle finger.
"Totally clear,"
confirmed the cat, having forgotten his promise to be a silent hallucination.
"The gist of this opus is now completely clear to me. What do you say, Azazello?"
he said, turning to the silent Azazello.
"I say," said the latter in a nasal twang, "that it would be a good idea to drown you." "Have mercy, Azazello," replied the cat, "and don't give my master any ideas. Take my word for it. I'd appear to you every night, wearing the same moonlight garb as the poor master here, and I'd beckon to you and lure you into following me. How would you like that, oh Azazello?"
"Well, Margarita," said Voland, joining the conversation once again, "tell me everything. What do you want?"
Margarita's eyes flashed, and she addressed Voland imploringly. "May I have a word with him?" Voland nodded, and Margarita leaned over to the master and whispered something in his ear. One could hear his reply to her. "No, it's too late. I want nothing more in life except to see you. But my advice to you is still the same. Leave me. If you stay with me, you'll be lost too." "No, I won't leave you," answered Margarita, and she turned to Voland. "I ask that we be returned to the basement apartment on the side street near the Arbat, and that the lamp be lit, and that everything be just as it was."
Here the master laughed, wrapped his arms around Margarita's long, disheveled, curly head, and said, "Don't listen to the poor woman, monsieur. Someone else has been living in that basement for a long time now. And besides, as a rule, things can't go back to what they were." He rested his cheek against his beloved Margarita's head, embraced her, and began murmuring, "My poor thing, my poor thing."
"Can't be as they were, you say?" said Voland. "That's true, but we'll give it a try." And he said, "Azazello!"
Immediately from the ceiling, there fell on the floor a bewildered and nearly deranged citizen clad only in his underwear, who was for some reason wearing a cap and holding a suitcase. The man was shaking and turning gray with fright.
"Are you Mogaritch?" Azazello inquired of the one who had fallen from the sky.
"Aloisi Mogaritch," the latter replied, trembling.
"Are you the one who read Latunsky's article on this man's novel, and then filed a complaint against him, saying that he had illegal literature in his possession?" asked Azazello.
The newly arrived citizen turned blue and burst into repentant tears.
"Was it because you wanted to move into his apartment?" asked Azazello in his most cordial nasal twang.
Heard in the room was the infuriated cat hissing and Margarita howling,
"No, the witch, no her," as she dug her nails in Aloisi Mogaritch's face.
A scuffle ensued. "What are you doing?" screamed the master in agony. "Margot, don't disgrace yourself."
"I protest, this is no disgrace," yelled the cat.
Korovyov pulled Margarita away. "'I had a bathroom put in!' cried the bloodied Mogarich, his teeth chattering and terrified. He started babbling some nonsense. "'The whitewashing alone, the sulfuric acid!
"'Well, it's good a bathroom's been added,' said Azazello approvingly. "'He needs to take a bath.'
Then he shouted,
"'Begone!'
Mogarich was then turned head over heels and propelled out of Volant's bedroom through the open window. The master's eyes popped, and he said under his breath, "'Why, that's even neater than what Ivan said about him.' Utterly shaken, he looked all around and finally said to the cat, "'Excuse me, was it thou, you, sir?' He corrected himself, not sure whether to use the intimate or polite form of address to the cat. "'Are you, sir, the same cat who got on the streetcar?'
"'I am.' "'Confirmed the cat, flattered, and he added, "'It's nice to hear you address a cat so politely. "'For some reason, cats are usually addressed with the familiar thou, "'despite the fact that no cat has ever drunk Bruderschaft with anyone.'
"'It seems to me, for some reason, that you, sir, are not an ordinary cat,' "'replied the master hesitantly. "'They'll still notice that I'm gone at the hospital,' he added timidly to Volant.
"'Well, why would they notice that?' replied Volant reassuringly, and then some books and papers appeared in his hands. "'Are these your medical records?'
"'Yes.' Kuravyov threw them into the fireplace.
"'No documents, no person,' said Kuravyov with satisfaction. "'And is this... "'Your landlord's tenants register?'
"'Yes.'
"'Who's registered in it? Aloisi Mogarich?'
Kuravyov blew on one of the pages of the tenants register.
"'There. He's gone. "'And please note, never was there. "'And if your landlord acts surprised, "'tell him Aloisi was someone he dreamt about. "'Mogarich? What Mogarich? "'There was never any Mogarich.'
"'Here,' the tied and secured register evaporated from Kuravyov's hands.
And now it's back on the landlord's desk.
You were absolutely right, said the master, impressed by the neatness of Kuravyov's work, when you said no documents, no person. So that means I don't exist, since I don't have any documents.
I beg your pardon, cried Kuravyov. That really is an hallucination. Here are your documents.
And Kuravyov handed them to the master. Then he shifted his gaze to Margarita and whispered sweetly to her,
"'And here is your property, Margarita Nikolaevna.'
Whereupon he handed her a notebook with charred edges, a dried rose, a photograph, and, with special care, a savings book.
"'Here's the 10,000-ruble deposit you made, Margarita Nikolaevna. We have no need of other people's money.' I'd rather have my paws wither and fall off than touch what belongs to someone else,
exclaimed the cat in puffed-up tones, dancing on top of the suitcase to flatten down all the copies of the ill-starred novel.
And here are your documents, too, continued Kuravyov, handing them to Margarita, and then, turning to Volant, he said respectfully, That's everything, monsieur.
No, not everything. "'Replied Volant, turning away from his globe. "'What are your orders, my dear lady, "'regarding the disposition of your retinue? "'I personally have no need of them.' "'At this point, Natasha, still naked, "'ran in through the open door. "'She clasped her hands and shouted to Margarita, "'Be happy, Margarita Nikolaevna!' "'She nodded in the direction of the master "'and again turned to Margarita. "'You see, I always knew where you were going.'
"'Maids know everything,' noted the cat, raising his paw sagaciously. "'It's a mistake to think they're blind.'
"'What do you want, Natasha?' asked Margarita. "'Go back to the house.' "'Darling Margarita Nikolaevna,' began Natasha imploringly, getting down on her knees. "'Ask them,' she looked sideways at Volant, "'to let me stay a witch. "'I don't want to go back to the house, not for an engineer, not for a technician.' "'Yesterday at the ball, Monsieur Jacques made me an offer.' "'Natasha opened her hand, revealing some gold coins. "'Margarita cast a questioning glance at Volant. "'He nodded. "'Then
Natasha threw herself on Margarita's neck, gave her a loud kiss, and flew out the window with a triumphant whoop. In Natasha's place appeared Nikolai Ivanovich. He had assumed his former human form, but he was extraordinarily glum and even, perhaps, annoyed. "Here's someone I shall dismiss with special pleasure," said Volant, looking disgustedly at Nikolai Ivanovich. "With exceptional pleasure, since he's totally superfluous here."
"Please, give me a certificate," began Nikolai Ivanovich,
looking around wildly but speaking with great insistence,
"stating where I spent last night."
"For what purpose?"
asked the cat sternly.
"To give to the police and to my wife,"
was Nikolai Ivanovich's firm response.
"We usually don't give certificates," said the cat with a frown. "But all right, for you will make an exception."
Before Nikolai Ivanovich could realize what was happening, the nude Hella was at the typewriter, taking dictation from the cat.
"I hereby certify that the bearer of this note, Nikolai Ivanovich, spent the night in question at Satan's Ball, having been lured there in a transportational capacity," Hella put in parentheses, "and write Hog. Signed, Behemoth."
"And the date?"
squealed Nikolai Ivanovich.
"We won't put in the date, otherwise the document will be null and void," retorted the cat, scribbling his signature.
He got a seal from somewhere, breathed on it in the customary fashion, affixed a seal saying paid, and handed the paper to Nikolai Ivanovich. After this, the latter disappeared without a trace, and in his place appeared another unexpected figure.
"So who's this now?" asked Volant squeamishly, shading his eyes from the glow of the candles.
Varenuha hung his head, sighed, and said softly,
"Let me go back. I'm not capable of being a vampire. Hella and I almost left Rimsky a goner. I'm just not bloodthirsty enough. Let me go."
"What's all this raving?" asked Volant with a frown. "Who's this Rimsky, and what's this nonsense all about?"
"You needn't trouble about this, monsieur,"
replied Azazello, and he turned to Varenuha.
"Don't be rude on the phone. Don't tell lies on the phone. Got it? Will you stop doing that?"
Varenuha's head was spinning from joy. His face began to glow, and without knowing what he was saying, he mumbled,
"As God is my... That is, I want to say, right after dinner."
Varenuha pressed his hands to his chest and looked pleadingly at Azazello.
"All right, then, go home,"
the latter replied, and Varenuha melted away.
"Now, everyone leave me alone with them," ordered Volant, indicating the master and Margarita.
Volant's order was immediately obeyed. After a brief silence, Volant addressed the master.
"So, you're going back to the basement apartment of the Arbat, is that it? What about your writing? Your dreams, your inspiration?"
"I no longer have any dreams, or inspiration either, for that matter," replied the master. "Nothing around me interests me except her." He again put his hands on Margarita's head. "They've broken me. I'm depressed, and I want to go back to my basement."
"What about your novel? What about Pilot?"
"It's hateful to me, that novel," answered the master. "I suffered too much because of it."
"I implore you," begged Margarita sorrowfully, "don't talk that way. Why are you torturing me? You know that I've put my whole life into your work."
And turning to Volant, she added, "Don't listen to him, monsieur. He's just worn out."
"But shouldn't you be writing about something?" said Volant. "If you've run out of things to say about the procurator, well, write about somebody else. That fellow... Aloisi, for example."
The master smiled. "Rabshonikova won't publish it. And besides, it's not interesting."
"But what will you live on? You'll be forced to live in poverty, you know."
"Gladly, gladly," replied the master, drawing Margarita to him once again. With his arms around her shoulders, he added, "She'll come to her senses and leave me."
"I don't think so," said Volant through his teeth, and continued, "And so the man who wrote the story of Pontius Pilate intends to go off to his basement and live there in poverty by his lamp. Is that right?"
Margarita detached herself from the master's embrace and began speaking very heatedly. I did everything I could, and I whispered to him the most tempting thing of all, and he refused it.
I know what you whispered to him, retorted Voland, but that isn't the most tempting thing. And to you I'll say, he smiled, turning to the master, your novel has some more surprises for you.
That's very sad, replied the master.
No, no, it isn't sad, said Voland. Nothing terrible will happen. Well, then, Margarita Nikolaevna, everything is done. Have you any further claims on me?
How can you say that? Oh, how can you, monsieur?
Then take this from me as a memento, said Voland, pulling a small, diamond-studded gold horseshoe from under his pillow.
No, 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 whatever for?
Do you wish to argue with me? Asked Voland, smiling.
Since she had no pocket in her cape, Margarita put the horseshoe in a napkin and tied it in a bundle. Here, something astonished her. She turned to the window where the moon was shining and said,
This is what I don't understand. How can it still be midnight, when it should have been morning long ago?
It's nice to hold on to a holiday midnight a little longer than usual, answered Voland. Well, I wish you happiness.
Margarita extended her hands prayerfully to Voland, but did not dare to get close to him, and she cried out softly,
Farewell! Farewell!
Till we meet again, said Voland.
And Margarita, in her black cape, the master in his hospital robe, stepped out into the hallway of the apartment of the jeweler's wife, where a candle was burning and where Voland's retinue was waiting for them. When they set out down the hall, Hella was carrying the suitcase containing the novel and Margarita Nikolaevna's meager belongings, and the cat was helping Hella. At the door of the apartment, Korovyov bowed and disappeared, while the others accompanied them down the stairs. The staircase was deserted. As they were crossing the third-floor landing, they heard a soft thud, but no one paid any attention to it. When they reached the front doors of entranceway number 6, Azazello blew upward, and as soon as they stepped into the courtyard, which the moonlight did not reach, they saw a man on the doorstep wearing boots and a cloth cap, who was seemingly sound asleep, and a large black car parked by the entrance with its lights off. Dimly visible through the windshield was the rook's silhouette. As they were about to get in the car, Margarita let out a soft cry of despair.
My God, I've lost the horseshoe!
Get in the car, said Azazello, and wait for me. I'll come right back as soon as I find out what happened.
And he went back to the front door. This is what had happened. Shortly before Margarita and the master left with their entourage, a shriveled woman holding a bag and a tin can came out of number 48, the apartment just below the jeweler's wife's. It was that same Anushka who, the previous Wednesday, had spilled sunflower oil at the turnstile, to Berlioz's great misfortune. Nobody knew, and probably nobody ever will, what this woman actually did in Moscow or what she lived on. The only thing that was known about Anushka was that she could be seen every day with the can, with the bag, or with both together, either at the oil shop, the market, outside the gates of the building, on the stairs, or, most frequently of all, in the kitchen of apartment number 48, which was where she lived. Besides that, the most notorious thing about her was that wherever she was, or wherever she appeared, trouble would start at once. And, finally, that her nickname was the Plague. For some reason, Anushka the Plague was in the habit of getting up incredibly early, and on that particular morning, something roused her from bed before the crack of dawn, just after midnight. The key turned in the door, Anushka's nose stuck out, and then the whole of her emerged, the door slammed shut behind her, and she was about to set off somewhere
when a door banged on the upstairs landing and someone rushed down the stairs, colliding with Anushka and knocking her sideways so that she struck the back of her head against the wall.
"Where's the devil taking you in just your drawers?" screeched Anushka, clutching the back of her head.
The man in his underwear, wearing a cap and holding a suitcase, and with his eyes closed, answered Anushka in a strange, sleepy voice, "The water pump, the sulfuric acid, the cost of the whitewash alone." And bursting into tears, he roared, "Go away!" Then he rushed, not further down the stairs, but back up the stairs to where the window pane had been kicked out by the economist, and he flew out that window head over heels into the courtyard. Forgetting about the pain in the back of her head, Anushka groaned and ran to the window herself. She lay flat on her stomach on the landing and stuck her head out into the courtyard, expecting to see the broken body of the man with the suitcase stretched out on the asphalt, lit up by the yard light. But there was absolutely nothing on the asphalt in the courtyard. She was left to assume that the strange and sleepy individual had flown out of the house like a bird, leaving no trace of himself. Anushka crossed herself and thought, "That number 50 really is cursed. No wonder people are talking. That's some apartment, that is." No sooner had she thought this than the door upstairs banged again, and down ran a second someone. Anushka pressed herself to the wall and saw a rather respectable-looking citizen with a beard but with a slightly pig-like face, or so it seemed to Anushka, dart past her and, like the preceding individual, leave the house through the window, again with no thought of smashing himself on the asphalt. Anushka had now forgotten the purpose of her outing, and she just stayed on the stairs, crossing herself, groaning, and talking to herself. Shortly after that, a third man, beardless, with a round, clean-shaven face, wearing a peasant blouse, ran out of the apartment upstairs and flew out the window in similar fashion. To give Anushka her due, it must be said that she was inquisitive and decided to wait a little longer to see if there would be any new marvels. The door upstairs opened again, and now a whole group of people headed down the stairs, but this time they were walking like normal people and not running. Anushka ran away from the window, went back down to her own door, opened it hastily, hid behind it, and her eye, in a frenzy of curiosity, glimmered through the crack. Someone who looked neither sick nor not sick, a strange, pale man in need of a shave and wearing a black cap and some kind of robe, was going down the stairs, supported by a lady in a black cassock, or so it appeared to Anushka in the semi-darkness. The lady was not exactly barefoot, but was wearing transparent, obviously foreign-made, evening slippers that had been torn to shreds.
Phew! Never mind the shoes. Why, the lady's actually naked. Well, almost. That cassock's thrown right over her naked body. That's some apartment, that is.
Anushka's soul sang with anticipation of the stories she would tell her neighbors the next day. Behind the strangely clad lady came a completely naked one carrying a small suitcase. And prowling nearby was a huge black cat. Rubbing her eyes, Anushka almost squealed out loud. Bringing up the rear of the procession was a short, limping, wall-eyed foreigner, jacketless, wearing a white dress vest and black tie. The whole company passed Anushka on its way downstairs. At this point, something made a soft thump on the landing. Hearing the footsteps fade, Anushka slithered out from behind the door like a snake, stood her oil can against the wall, lay down on her stomach, and started feeling around on the floor of the landing. Her hands picked up something heavy wrapped in a napkin. Anushka's eyes bulged out of her head when she undid the bundle. She held the jewel up to her eyes, and her eyes burned with a wolfish fire. Thoughts whirled through Anushka's head.
I don't know nothing. I don't know a thing. Should I show it to my nephew, or break it into pieces? The stones could be pried out and sold one at a time, one on the Pietrovka, another on Smolensky. But the main thing is, I don't know nothing, and I don't know a thing.
Anushka hid her find in her bosom,
grabbed her oil can, and was about to slither back into her apartment, having decided to postpone her trip to town, when there arose before her, the devil knows from where, that same fellow with the white shirt front and no jacket, and he whispered quietly,
"Give me the horseshoe and the napkin."
"What horseshoe napkin?"
asked Anushka, feigning ignorance very skillfully.
"I don't know nothing about no napkin. What are you, citizen, drunk or something?"
Without saying another word, the white-chested man squeezed Anushka's throat with fingers as hard as the handrail on a bus, and just as cold, cutting off the air to her lungs. The oil can dropped out of Anushka's hands and fell onto the floor. After cutting off Anushka's air for some moments, the jacketless foreigner removed his fingers from her neck. Gulping for air, Anushka smiled.
"Oh, you mean the little horseshoe," she began. "Here it is. So it belongs to you? I look and I see it there in the napkin. I took it on purpose so that nobody would pick it up. Otherwise, you could kiss it goodbye."
After receiving the horseshoe and napkin, the foreigner began to bow and scrape before Anushka, shaking her hand firmly and thanking her warmly with a very pronounced foreign accent in expressions like these.
"I am deeply grateful to you, madame. I cherish this horseshoe as a keepsake, and please allow me to present you with 200 rubles for keeping it safe."
And he took the money out of his vest pocket at once and handed it to Anushka. She, grinning foolishly, could only blurt out,
"Oh, I thank you most humbly. Merci, merci."
The generous foreigner made it to the bottom of the flight in one fell swoop, but before slipping away completely, he shouted from below, this time without an accent,
"You old witch, if you ever find anything else that doesn't belong to you, turn it over to the police, and don't hide it in your bosom."
Her head agog and abuzz from all these happenings on the staircase, Anushka kept shouting,
"Merci, merci, merci,"
for a long time out of inertia. But the foreigner was long gone. The car was also gone from the courtyard. After returning Voland's gift to Margarita, Azazello said goodbye to her, asked if she was comfortably seated. Hella enthusiastically smothered Margarita with kisses. The cat kissed her hand. The group waved to the master, who, lifeless and inert, had sunk into the corner of his seat. Then they waved to the rook and immediately melted into thin air, not considering it worth the trouble to climb back up the stairs. The rook turned on the headlights and rolled the car out through the gates past the man who was fast asleep at the gateway. And the lights of the big black car blended in with the other lights on sleepless and noisy Sadovaya Street. An hour later, in the basement of the small house on one of the side streets off the Arbat, in the front room, where everything was just as it had been a year ago before that terrible autumn night, at the table covered with the velvet tablecloth, beneath the shaded lamp, near which stood the vase filled with lilies of the valley, Margarita sat, weeping quietly from the shock and happiness she had experienced. The fire-damaged notebook lay before her, and next to it towered a pile of undamaged notebooks. The little house was silent. In the small adjoining room, sound asleep on the couch, covered by his hospital robe, was the master. His even breathing could not be heard. When she had cried her fill, Margarita took up the undamaged notebooks and found the place she had been rereading before her meeting with Azazello beneath the Kremlin wall. Margarita did not feel like sleeping. She stroked the manuscript affectionately, as one would stroke a beloved cat, and turned it over in her hands, looking at it from all sides, now pausing at the title page, now looking at the end. She suddenly had a horrible thought that it was all witchcraft, that the notebooks were about to vanish before her eyes, that she would end up in her bedroom back home, and that when she woke up, she would have to go drown herself. But that was the last horrible thought she had, a vestige of the prolonged suffering she had undergone. Nothing vanished. The omnipotent Voland was indeed omnipotent, and Margarita was free to leaf through the pages of the notebooks for as long as she liked, even till dawn. She examined them closely, kissed them, and reread the words again and again. The darkness that had come in from the Mediterranean covered the city so detested by the procurator. Yes, the darkness.
Chapter 25. How the Procurator Tried to Save Judas of Kerioth. The darkness that had come in from the Mediterranean covered the city so detested by the Procurator. The hanging bridges which connected the temple with the fearsome Antonia Tower had disappeared. An abyss descended from the sky and covered the winged gods above the Hippodrome, the Hasmonean Palace and its embrasures, the bazaars, the caravanseries, the alleys, the ponds. Yerushalayim, the great city, vanished as if it had never existed. Everything was devoured by the darkness, which frightened all living creatures in Yerushalayim and its surroundings. A strange dark cloud drifted in from the sea towards the end of the afternoon on the 14th day of the spring month of Nisan. The cloud had already spilled its belly onto Bald Skull. Where the executioners had hastily pierced the condemned men, it had broken over the temple in Yerushalayim, coursed down its hills and steamy rivulets, and flooded the lower city. The cloud gushed through windows and chased people indoors from the winding streets. It was slow to release its moisture, and at first gave off only light. Whenever fire ripped through the steamy black brew, the great hulk of the temple with its glistening, scaly roof soared out of the pitch darkness into view. But the fire was extinguished in an instant, and the temple again sank into the dark abyss. It leaped out several times, only to fall back again, and each time its fall was accompanied by the thunder of catastrophe. Other quivering flashes of light summoned from the abyss the palace of Herod the Great, that stood opposite the temple on the western hill, and its fearsome, eyeless golden statues soared up into the black sky with their arms extended. But the heavenly fire hid once again, and heavy claps of thunder drove the golden idols back into the darkness. The downpour broke out unexpectedly, and then the thunderstorm turned into a hurricane. On the very spot near the marble bench in the garden where the procurator had conversed with the high priest around noontime, there was a crack of thunder like a cannon shot, and a cypress tree broke in two like a cane. Mingling with watery dust and hail, torn roses, magnolia leaves, small twigs, and sand swept through the colonnade onto the balcony. The hurricane scourged the garden. At this time, there was only one man under the colonnade, and that man was the procurator. Now he was not sitting in his chair, but was instead reclining on a couch next to a low table set with food and jugs of wine. Another couch, unoccupied, stood on the other side of the table. A red puddle, which looked like blood and had not been cleaned up, was spreading out from under the procurator's feet, and in it were pieces of a broken jug. The servant who had been setting the table before the storm had become flustered by the procurator's stare and upset that he had displeased him in some way, and the procurator, angry at the servant, had smashed the jug on the mosaic floor, saying, "Why don't you look me in the eye when you serve me? Have you stolen something?" The African's black face turned gray. Mortal terror appeared in his eyes. He began to tremble and almost broke the other jug. But for some reason the procurator's anger subsided as quickly as it had flared up. Just as the African was about to pick up the broken pieces and wipe up the puddle, the procurator waved him away, and the slave ran off. And the puddle remained. Now, as the hurricane raged, the African huddled near a niche which held a statue of a white, naked woman bowing her head. The African was afraid of showing himself at the wrong moment, yet also fearful lest he miss the procurator's summons. Reclining on his couch in the semi-darkness of the storm, the procurator poured himself some wine, drank it in long gulps, and reached occasionally for the bread, crumbling it and swallowing it in small pieces. Now and again he would suck on an oyster, chew on a slice of lemon, and then take another drink. Were it not for the roar of the water, the claps of thunder that threatened to smash in the palace roof, the clatter of hail that pounded against the balcony steps, it might have been possible to hear the procurator mumbling something as he talked to himself. And if the intermittent flickers of heavenly fire had been transformed into a steady light, an observer might have been able to see that the procurator's face, its eyes inflamed by wine and by recent bouts of insomnia, expressed impatience. That the procurator was not only gazing at the two white roses which had drowned in the red puddle, but was constantly turning his face toward the garden and the onslaught of watery dust and sand. That he was waiting for someone, waiting impatiently.
This ends Disc 11. The Master and Margarita, Disc 12.
A short time passed, and the veil of water before the procurator's eyes began to thin. As fierce as the hurricane had been, it was growing weaker. Branches no longer cracked and fell. The claps of thunder and flashes of lightning became less frequent. The violet coverlet with the white trim that had been floating above Yerushalayim was gone, and all that remained was an ordinary gray rear guard cloud. The thunderstorm was moving out to the Dead Sea. Now it was possible to hear the separate sounds of the rain and of the water as it streamed through the gutters and down the steps of the staircase which the procurator had traversed earlier that day when he had gone to announce the sentence in the square. And finally, the gush of the fountain could be heard, which earlier had been drowned out. It was growing lighter. Dark blue windows began to appear in the gray veil that was sweeping eastward. Then, from afar, breaking through the patter of the now utterly feeble drizzle, the faint sounds of trumpets and the clatter of several hundred hooves reached the procurator's ears. Hearing those sounds, the procurator shifted position and his face became animated. The Ayla was returning from Bald Mountain. Judging by the sound, it was moving across the square where the sentence had been pronounced. At last, the procurator heard both the long-awaited footsteps and the shuffling on the staircase that led to the garden's upper terrace right in front of the balcony. The procurator craned his neck, and his eyes began to sparkle with joy. The first thing to appear between the two marble lions was a head in a hood, followed by a drenched man in a cloak that stuck to his body. It was the same man who had had a hushed conversation with the procurator in a darkened room of the palace before the pronouncement of the sentence, and who, during the execution, had sat on a three-legged stool, playing with a twig. Heedless of the puddles, the man in the hood cut across the garden terrace, stepped onto the mosaic floor of the balcony, and raising his arms, said in a pleasant, high-pitched voice, "Health and happiness to the procurator." The newcomer spoke in Latin.
"Gods," exclaimed Pilate, "you haven't a dry thread on you. What a hurricane, eh? Please go to my room. Do me the favor of changing into dry clothes."
The visitor threw off his hood, revealing his completely soaked head, his hair plastered to his forehead, and with a polite smile on his clean-shaven face, he began to refuse a change of clothes, assuring the procurator that a little rain would cause him no harm.
"I won't hear of it," replied Pilate.
He clapped his hands and summoned the servants who had been hiding from him to attend to the visitor's needs, and then to serve hot food at once. The procurator's visitor required very little time to dry his hair, change his clothes and footwear, and tidy up in general, and he soon appeared on the balcony steps in dry sandals, a dry crimson military cloak, and with his hair smoothed down. By this time the sun had returned to Yerushalayim, and before departing to sink into the Mediterranean, it sent its farewell rays to the city detested by the procurator and gilded the balcony steps. The fountain had revived completely and was gurgling at full strength. The pigeons had come out on the sand and were cooing and hopping over the broken twigs and pecking at something in the wet sand. The red puddle had been mopped up, the pieces of broken pottery had been cleared away, and meat was steaming on the table.
I await the procurator's orders, said the visitor, approaching the table.
But you will hear none until you sit down and have some wine, replied Pilate courteously, indicating the other couch. The visitor reclined, and a servant poured deep red wine into his cup. Another servant leaned carefully over Pilate's shoulder and filled the procurator's cup. When this was done, the latter signaled both servants to leave. While the visitor ate and drank, Pilate, sipping his wine, watched his guest with narrowed eyes. The man who had appeared before Pilate was middle-aged, with a very pleasant, round, well-groomed face, with a fleshy nose. His hair was of indeterminate color. Now, as it dried, it grew lighter. It would have been hard to guess the visitor's nationality. The main thing that defined his face was probably its good-natured expression, an expression belied, however, by his eyes, or, more precisely, not by the eyes themselves, but by the way the visitor looked at his interlocutor. Usually the visitor concealed his small eyes beneath their somewhat odd, puffy-looking lids. A benign slyness shone in the slits of his eyes when he did this. One had to suppose that the procurator's guest was a man inclined to humor, but the humor gleaming in the slits of his eyes would occasionally be banished when the present guest of the procurator would open his eyelids wide and stare suddenly and directly at his interlocutor, as if he were trying to locate some imperceptible spot on his nose. This would last only for a moment, after which his eyelids would drop again, the slits would reappear, and they would shine again with the same goodwill and sly intelligence. The visitor did not refuse a second cup of wine, swallowed several oysters with obvious pleasure, sampled the boiled vegetables, and ate a piece of meat. After eating his fill, he praised the wine. A superb wine, procurator. Is it a Falernum? A 30-year-old succubum, replied the procurator amiably.
The guest pressed his hand to his heart, declined any more food, and said he was full. Then Pilate filled his own cup, and his guest did the same. Both of them poured some of their wine onto a platter with the meat, and, raising his cup, the procurator said in a low voice,
To us, to you, Caesar, father of the Romans, dearest and best of men.
After this they drank their wine, and the Africans cleared the table of food, leaving just the fruit and the jugs. Once again the procurator signaled the servants to leave, and he and his guest were left alone under the colonnade.
And so, Pilate began softly, what can you tell me of the mood in the city?
Involuntarily he turned his gaze to the place beyond and below the garden terraces where the colonnades and flat roofs were being gilded by the sun's last rays.
I believe, procurator, replied the guest, that the mood in Yerushalayim is now satisfactory.
So we can count on there being no more disturbances.
We can count, replied the guest, looking affectionately at the procurator, on only one thing in this world, the power of the mighty Caesar.
May the gods grant him long life, joined in Pilate immediately, and universal peace.
After a brief silence, he continued.
So, you think we can have the troops withdrawn?
I think that the lightning cohort can be withdrawn, replied the guest, adding, but it would be a good idea if it marched around the city as it left.
A very good idea, the procurator agreed. I shall have the lightning cohort withdrawn the day after tomorrow, and I myself shall leave. And I swear to you, by the Feast of the 12 Gods and by the Lares, I would have given a great deal to have been able to leave today.
The procurator does not like Yerushalayim?
Queried the guest good-humoredly.
Have mercy on me, exclaimed the procurator, smiling. There is no more hopeless place on earth, to say nothing of the climate. I get sick every time I am forced to come here. But that alone would not be so bad. It's these holidays, magicians, sorcerers, wizards, these hordes of pilgrims, fanatics. Look at the trouble caused by this Messiah alone.
who they've suddenly started waiting for this year, every minute expecting to have to witness some ghastly bloodbath. Constantly having to transfer troops around, reading accusations and denunciations, half of which are written against you yourself. You will agree that's tedious. Oh, if it weren't for the Imperial Service.
Yes, the holidays here are difficult, agreed the guest.
With all my heart, I wish them to be over soon, added Pilate vigorously. Then I shall at last be able to return to Caesarea. Can you believe that this absurd construction of Herod's... The procurator waved his hand at the colonnade to show that he was referring to the palace. ...is positively driving me out of my mind. I cannot bear to spend the night here. No stranger piece of architecture has ever been seen. But let's get back to business. First of all, is that damn Baraban causing you any concern? Here the guest looked at the procurator's cheek with that peculiar stare of his. But the procurator was gazing off into the distance with a bored expression, frowning with distaste and contemplating that part of the city which lay at his feet and was fading into the dusk. The guest's stare also faded, and his eyelids drooped.
"One must assume that Bar is now as harmless as a lamb," began the guest, wrinkles appearing on his round face. "It's awkward for him to rebel now."
"Because he's too famous?" asked Pilate with a laugh.
"As always, the procurator shows a subtle grasp of the issue."
"But in any case," the procurator noted with concern, raising a long, slender finger that bore a ring with a black stone, "it will be necessary to..."
"Oh, the procurator can rest assured that, so long as I am in Judea, Bar will not take a step without me being at his heels."
"Now I am calm, as, by the way, I always am when you are here."
"The procurator is too kind."
"And now please tell me about the execution," said the procurator.
"What is it precisely that interests the procurator?"
"Were there no attempts by the crowd to express their outrage? That's the main thing, of course."
"None," replied the guest.
"Very good. Did you yourself establish that death had occurred?"
"The procurator can be sure of that."
"And tell me, were they given a drink before being hanged on the posts?"
"Yes, but he..."
Here the guest closed his eyes. "Refused to drink anything." "Whom do you mean?" asked Pilate.
"Forgive me, Hegemon," exclaimed the guest. "Did I not give his name Hanotsri?"
"Madman," said Pilate, grimacing for some reason. A vein twitched under his left eye. "Dying from exposure to the sun. Why refuse what is allowed by the law?" "How did he express his refusal?"
"He said," replied the guest, again closing his eyes, "that he was grateful and cast no blame for the taking of his life."
"On whom?" asked Pilate in a hollow voice.
"That he did not say, Hegemon."
"Did he try to preach anything in front of the soldiers?"
"No, Hegemon, he was not talkative on this occasion. The only thing he said was that he considered cowardice one of the worst of all human vices."
"What made him say that?" the guest heard a suddenly cracked voice say.
"There is no way of knowing. His behavior was strange in general, as it always was, I might add."
"What was strange about it?"
"He kept trying to look those around him in the eyes, and he kept smiling a distracted kind of smile."
"Nothing else?" asked the hoarse voice.
"Nothing else."
The procurator banged his cup as he poured himself more wine. After draining it to the dregs, he began speaking. "This is the fact of the matter. Although we have been unable, at least for the present, to locate any of his disciples or followers, we should not assume that there are none." The guest listened attentively, his head bowed. "And so, to avoid surprises of any kind," continued the procurator,
Immediately and without any fuss, please make the bodies of all three executed men disappear from the face of the earth and bury them quietly and in secret, so that neither hide nor hair of them remains.
Yes, Hegemon, said the guest, and rose, saying, In view of the complexity and seriousness of this matter, permit me to leave right away.
No. Sit down for a while longer, said Pilate, gesturing to his guest to stay. There are two other matters. First, your vast accomplishments in the highly demanding